Review of chapters 1 through 9 of Isaiah and Isaiah chapter 10. The ninth talk in a series on Isaiah was presented by David Crabtree on September 23, 2012 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2012. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
We're going to be looking at Isaiah chapter 10 eventually, but we're going to do a little bit of sightseeing before we get there. It's been a few weeks since I taught on the first nine chapters of Isaiah, so I thought that it might be good to do a little bit of a review. It might help you. It certainly helps me to remember what I said last time. I'm going to briefly summarize the first nine chapters of the book. And that is not an easy task because the presentation is not systematic. I was trying to think of what would be an analogy to the kind of organization that we have in Isaiah. And it's like many of the modern films with lots of jump cuts. So you've got a little vignette, and you see an image, it kind of gives you an impression that's quite vivid, and then it moves to something else. And then it'll move to something else. And it just goes like that. And the job of the viewer is to figure out what are the connections. Why is this image in front of me right now, and how does it relate to the other images? So I think that's probably the best analogy for what we have. So we've got a bunch of these jump cuts that we have to put together and make sense of, and so I'm going to do that, but I'm not going to present it in the order that it's presented. I'm going to give it a little bit of a more logical organization and a more digested organization. The setting for Isaiah is in the 700s, about 720 or so BC. Isaiah was from Jerusalem. He apparently is well connected. He seems to know people in the palace. Seems to be able to move around about in the palace and knows what is being talked about in the environs of the kingdom. And he's talking apparently primarily to the leadership of Judah. This is the kingdom of Judah, the southern kingdom. They've split at this point in time and have been split for some time. So he's speaking primarily to the leadership of Judah, but apparently what he has to say spreads out more broadly to the people at large within Jerusalem. And the time at which he is speaking is an ominous time. It's ominous because there have been four kings in the environs who have recently died and are being replaced by new kings coming to the throne. In Judah, we have a change in the king. In Israel, we have a change in the king. In Aram or Syria, there's a recent change in the king. And most significantly, in Assyria, further to the east, in Mesopotamia, there's been a change in who the king is. And there seems to be kind of an ominous feeling within Judah that there are going to be significant changes taking place. The only question is, what are those changes going to be? But there's a sense that it's not likely to be good, that things look ominous. And I was trying to think of what to liken that to, and it occurred to me that our time right now, in which we are living, has some of that same kind of ominousness to it. And this is, I think, regardless of whether you're on the right or the left end of the political spectrum, I think everybody can look out at the world situation and see that things are troubled. what we've had is the decline of the Soviet Union, and with the decline of the Soviet Union, the United States becomes the dominant power in the world. But a dominant power in the world without a clear adversary creates a difficult dynamic, and that's what we're experiencing. And there's a kind of power shift taking place. Power is shifting from the United States. It's not clear where it's shifting to, but there is a power shift that I think we can all sense happening. There are things in the Middle East that are troubling. There are things, what's happening in Russia is troubling. And even things in Europe are unsettled, particularly economically. We've got the recession has created a worldwide cascade of problems that we are experiencing. As a result, I think it's not a coincidence that there is a lot of talk about the apocalypse right now. There are movies about the apocalypse coming out. There's talk about the Mayan calendar and December 12th coming up as a momentous day. So there's just a lot of kind of uneasiness just below the surface, and kind of wondering where are things going, and the sense that it doesn't look entirely good. And the shift of power, what's going to happen? Who's going to emerge as the leader in the world, and how's that going to play out? And I think that's similar to the situation that they were facing in Judah at the time of Isaiah. In particular, Judah was being pressured by the two kingdoms to the north, the kingdom of Israel, the northern kingdom of the divided kingdom of that had been established by David. So Israel to the north, and then a little bit further to the north and a little bit to the east, Aram or Syria, those two countries wanted to form an alliance against Assyria. With a new king in Assyria, they're afraid that Assyria is going to reemerge as a power like it had been in the past. And they were afraid that it would reemerge as a world power. And if it were to do so, in all likelihood, it would start coming west. And it would come on expeditions of conquest. And Aram, Israel, and Judah would all be in its path. That's what they're anticipating. So they want to form an alliance, get as many of these little kingdoms in the west together as possible to fight against Assyria. And Israel and Syria are so intent on this project of developing a strong alliance that if the king of Judah does not comply, they have even talked about fomenting a revolution within Judah, deposing the king and replacing him with one that would be more amenable to their plans. And Isaiah's counsel in the midst of that, and with respect to that particular issue, is don't do it. Don't ally yourselves with Israel and Syria in the anti-Assyrian alliance. And that is a difficult stance to take, because if they don't ally themselves with Israel and Syria, then they will be by themselves to face the Assyrian onslaught. Okay, so that's the setting in which this Isaiah starts out. Now, there are four main themes that he's charting out in the first nine chapters, and just let me go through those four themes. The first one is that Judah has been unfaithful to God. That's a theme that all of the prophets hit on. That's definitely it's probably the major theme of what Isaiah has to say. What's interesting about this is that I think that the evil that God is identifying here, that's at the heart of things, is not an outrageous evil. He's not accusing them of murder and rape. It's not outrageous evil that he's accusing them of. It's true, he does call them murderers, but I think they're murderers in the sense in which Jesus used the term in the Sermon on the Mount, where he says, if you call another person a fool, then you have violated the commandment of thou shalt not murder. So I don't think that it's outrageous evil that Isaiah is pinpointing as the heart of the evil that Judah is guilty of. It is true that he refers to Judah as being like Sodom and Gomorrah. But again, I don't think that's indicative that the evil is an outrageous evil in the sense that we would think about it. They seem to see themselves in Judah as being faithful to God. They are religious. They are fulfilling the commandments that God had asked them to fulfill. Look at Isaiah chapter 1, 10 through 15. It says, hear the word of the Lord, you rulers of Sodom. Give ear to the instruction of our God, you people of Gomorrah. What are your multiplied sacrifices to me, says the Lord? I have had enough of burnt offerings of rams and the fat of fed cattle, and I take no pleasure in the blood of bulls, lambs, or goats. When you come to appear before me, who requires of you this trampling of my courts? Bring your worthless offerings no longer. Incense is an abomination to me. New moon and Sabbath, the calling of assemblies, I cannot endure iniquity and the solemn assembly. I hate your new moon festivals and your appointed feasts. They have become a burden to me. I am weary of bearing them. So when you spread out your hands in prayer, I will hide my eyes from you. Yes, even though you multiply prayers, I will not listen. Your hands are covered with blood. So they're religious, but their religiosity is absolutely worthless. And in fact, it's insulting. That religion in the absence of a pure heart is before God an abomination. What seems to be at the heart of the evil of Judah is what's mentioned at the very outset. I'll read just verses 2 and 3 of chapter 1. Listen, O heavens, and hear, O earth, for the Lord speaks. Sons have I reared up and brought up, but they have revolted against me. An ox knows its owner, and a donkey its master's manger, but Israel does not know, my people do not understand. It's a great image there. Dumb animals know who feeds them. But the people of Judah don't know who cares and provides for them. And I think, as in a sense, as innocent as that evil seems, that's right at the heart of what God is condemning. That is to say that the people of Judah don't recognize what God has done for them, continues to do for them. They don't see it. It's completely missed on them. God has been caring for them for centuries, really. Sometimes in very dramatic ways, at the Exodus, God acted in very dramatic ways, miraculous ways. But for the most part, God's activity on behalf of Judah has been just kind of quiet behind the scenes, taking care of them, providing for them, and protecting them, nurturing them. And yet the people of Judah, they can't see it. Why can't they see it? Because those things just happen. It's easy to take that for granted, and that's what they have done. They want dramatic and abundant provision for their needs. They want God to act in ways that are overt, clearly visible, dramatic. And they want to be taken well cared for. They want to have an abundance of things so there's not even any fear of running out, rather than the just enough to get by kind of provision that God often provides. This ingratitude towards God then works itself out into other evils. Because they can't see what God is doing for them, in their minds, no one is caring for them. Their care is in their own hands. Their security is something that they have to procure themselves, because it's not going to come from any place else. As a result, it causes them to have a different kind of perspective on the world. That is, it's a world in which I have to look out for myself. I have to make sure that my future is taken care of. And so I have to get. Not only do I have to get, I have to stockpile. Because who knows what might happen in the near future. As a result, what happens is they become uncharitable to the poor. Why? Because I have to keep and protect what I have. I take advantage of the poor. Why? Because I need stuff. I need stuff. I need power. And who are the people that I can get it from? I can get it easiest from those who are most vulnerable. They are acquisitive. They want to amass property. And that's mentioned on a couple of occasions. Furthermore, they turn to other gods. They don't necessarily abandon Yahweh. He may come in handy someday. But they're looking around. They want to keep their options open. They want to make sure that they've got enough fire insurance. And as a result of all of this, there develops an arrogance. And there are a couple of instances where that's pointed out by Isaiah. So it starts rather innocently. It's a small evil in a sense, but it has all kinds of ramifications. And that is what God is outraged by. It is their rebellion and a determination, a deep-seated refusal to be single-mindedly devoted to the one true God. In the other prophets, it is common for them to use the illustration of an adulteress. That is, that the kingdom of Israel and the kingdom of Judah were adulteresses with respect to God. And what that's suggesting is that they want to keep their options open. They are not single-mindedly devoted to God. They want to kind of keep their options open because there may be spiritual benefits that can be derived elsewhere that would be more satisfying. The second theme, that's the first theme then, is the wickedness that exists within Judah. The second one is that they are going to be judged for that wickedness. Isaiah gives a parable that kind of explains the justification for the punishment that will come. Chapter 5, verses 1 through 7. Let me sing now for my well-beloved a song of my beloved concerning his vineyard. My well-beloved had a vineyard on a fertile hill, and he dug it all around, removed its stones, and planted it with the choicest vine. And he built a tower in the middle of it, and he hewed out a wine vat in it, and then he expected it to produce good grapes, but it produced only worthless ones. And now, O inhabitants of Jerusalem and men of Judah, judge between me and my vineyard. What more was there to do for my vineyard that I have not done in it? Why, when I expected it to produce good grapes, did it produce worthless ones? So now let me tell you what I am going to do to my vineyard. I will remove its hedge, and it will be consumed. I will break down its wall, and it will become trampled ground. And I will lay it waste. It will not be pruned or hoed, but briars and thorns will come up. I will also charge the clouds to rain no rain on it. So the parable here is of God who has established this vineyard and gone to great effort to plant it, to water it, to cultivate the ground, to build a wine vat, and to put a hedge around it, a wall around it, to protect it. All the things that the establisher of the vineyard has done to care for it. And what happens? The vineyard produces bad grapes. So the response of the vineyard, the farmer, is he's going to break down those walls and he's going to allow it to be overrun, allow it to be trampled. And that's an image of what God is doing with respect to Judah. That Judah has produced nothing but worthless grapes. And so God is going to remove his protection, going to remove his care for it, and allow it to be trampled in hopes that Judah will repent. In chapter 1, verses 5 and 6, it describes vividly God's perspective. He's inflicting pain and punishment on Judah, but he takes no pleasure in that. Here's what he says. Where will you be stricken again as you continue in your rebellion? The whole head is sick and the whole heart is faint. From the sole of the foot even to the head, there is nothing sound in it, only bruises, welts, and raw wounds, not pressed out or bandaged, nor softened with oil. So a description of someone who has been disciplined, who's been punished all over his body such that there is no place that's left unharmed. And the wounds have not been cared for. There's nobody to care for them. And that's what Judah is like and will be like. And God takes no pleasure in that, but God is going to accomplish his purposes. He wants to bring about, he wants to encourage a repentance. So there are several passages then in these first nine chapters that describe in greater detail what some of the punishments that Judah will experience are going to be like. All of them in kind of poetic form, it's hard to sort out exactly what's going to happen. But it does describe extreme suffering, and there is a refrain that's repeated several times throughout these chapters. And that is, it says, in spite of all this, his anger does not turn away, and his hand is still stretched out. It'll talk about something that will happen to Judah, but more is coming. It'll talk about more, and then it'll say, but more is coming. Clearly, what's being described is a whole series of trials, of disciplining. There are some suggestions that God's disciplining of Judah is going to have implications, not just for Judah, but much more widely in the world. There are suggestions, I think, that this is worldwide affliction of punishment that's being experienced. Now just look at just one passage, Isaiah 2, 12 through 17. It says, "For the Lord of hosts will have a day of reckoning against everyone who is proud and lofty and against everyone who is lifted up, that he may be abased. And it will be against all the cedars of Lebanon that are lofty and lifted up, against all the oaks of Bashan, against all the lofty mountains, against all the hills that are lifted up, against every high tower, against every fortified wall, against all the ships of Tarshish, and against all the beautiful craft. And the pride of man will be humbled, and the loftiness of man will be abased, and the Lord alone will be exalted in that day. And we could go on. It doesn't say that this disciplining of Judah that takes place will be necessarily worldwide, but the wording in here, I think, suggests that it is quite broad. And if we take seriously what it says in 12, literally what it says in 12, everyone who is proud and lofty will be stricken. Then it is worldwide. The third theme that's followed through here is that only a remnant of Judah will survive. There's one passage where it suggests that the people of Judah will be reduced to just a small remnant on at least two occasions. Chapter 6, verses 11 through 13. This is after Isaiah is commissioned to go out as a prophet. He turns to God and has a brief interaction. He says, "Lord, how long?" And he answered, "Until cities are devastated and without inhabitant, houses are without people, and the land is utterly desolate. The Lord has removed men far away, and the forsaken places are many in the midst of the land. Yet there will be a tenth portion in it, and it will again be subject to burning, like a terebinth or an oak whose stump remains when it is felled. The holy seed is its stump." So Judah will be reduced to just a tenth portion that is still in the land, and then again be subject to burning. And so that tenth will then be subjected to disciplining. And all that remains will be a stump, and it characterizes it a stump of an oak. Kurt McKinney mentioned to me that the oak is one of the few trees that if you cut it down and leave just a stump, it will grow back from that. And that's what's suggested here, is that it'll be cut down, but it will grow back. There's the holy seed is its stump. So a remnant will survive. That's the third theme in here, and that's a very important one. And the fourth theme that comes out is that Israel will eventually play a glorious role in the world. Jerusalem in particular is going to become a beacon of righteousness to the whole world. Look at Isaiah 2, 1 through 4. I'll start with verse 2 through 4. "Now it will come about in the last days, the mountain of the house of the Lord will be established as the chief of the mountains, and will be raised above the hills, and all the nations will stream to it. And many peoples will come and say, 'Come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob, that he may teach us concerning his ways, and that we may walk in his paths. For the law will go forth from Zion, and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. And he will judge between the nations, and will render decisions for many peoples. And they will hammer their swords into plowshares, and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation will not lift up sword against nation, and never again will they learn war.'" So the time will come, eventually the time will come, when Judah, and particularly Jerusalem, will serve a unique role in the world, and that is a very glorious role. It will be the seed of righteousness in the world. And the implication seems to be, therefore, you, the people of Judah, live according to your destiny. Live in a way that is befitting the destiny that awaits you. Okay, so those are the four themes that keep popping up in the first five verses and then first five chapters, and then even into the sixth, seventh, eighth, and ninth chapters. But in chapter six, there's a kind of change in what's happening. That is to say that in chapter six, it starts talking about Isaiah and the role that he is going to play as God's prophet. In chapter six, Isaiah sees a vision in which he beholds God himself in the temple. And by seeing God, Isaiah is greatly humbled and feels absolutely inadequate, feels dirty, feels unclean. And as a result, the seraphim take coals from the incense and they come to Isaiah and they burn his lips and purify them. Then God is musing and is thinking, who could I send to my people? Who can take a message to my people? And Isaiah says, well, I'd be glad to do it. Send me. And it's at that point then that Isaiah is commissioned to be a prophet to the people of Judah. So Isaiah goes, and the first thing that he is asked to do is to meet the king Ahab at a pool within Jerusalem. And he's supposed to take his son, Shear-Jashub. The name Shear-Jashub means a remnant shall return. I think that's right. Yes, a remnant will return. So the name is kind of a reminder that Israel or Judah's survival is assured. And we'll talk about this at the end, but that's extremely important in the Old Testament presentation as a whole. So the outcome with respect to that is settled. There's no question but what Judah will survive. The people of Israel will survive. So Isaiah takes his son, and they go and they meet Ahaz. And as instructed by God, Isaiah says, pick a sign. God will care for Judah. You can rest assured that God will care for Judah. But pick a sign, any sign. And Ahaz says, oh, no, I'm not going to pick a sign. I'm not going to test God. And I'm not sure exactly what's going on there, but I think it's kind of a self-righteousness maybe. But in any case, Isaiah says, okay, if you aren't going to pick a sign, then God will pick the sign. And the sign that God picks is a bizarre sign. It's an unusual sign. And there's a sense of which it's no sign. It's not dramatic. It's not miraculous in the sense of what we would like for signs. He says, a young woman, and I won't go into a discussion of that today because I have done that before, but I'd be willing to do it again if that's important. A young woman will be with child, and the name of that child will be Emmanuel. Emmanuel means God with us. So a child will be born whose name is God with us. And what Isaiah says is that before he grows up to the point where he can tell right from wrong, Israel and Aram will be destroyed. The two countries that you're worried about right now, the two countries that you think are going to come against you and destroy you, they will be destroyed. As a result, then, this boy, whose name is Emmanuel, and by his name as a reminder of what God had promised. As he grows up, the clock is ticking. So he's just this little walking clock. And as he gets older, then the time is coming when what God said would come to pass will come to pass. Then, later, Isaiah gives another sign to the king. He says that a child is going to be born, and I suspect it's the same child, but I don't know that for sure. And that this child will be given the name Maher Shalal Hashbaz, which means swift is the booty, speedy is the prey. In other words, in no time, Israel and Aram will be captured and carried away as plunder. And Isaiah says that before the child is eating curds and honey, that Israel and Aram will be gone. So now we have a shorter clock that is ticking away. And in addition to the child being born, what he asks is that Isaiah write this out on a board with witnesses present. A curious thing. So we've got two signs here. We've got a child who is this walking clock who is growing and developing and changing and who has a name of significance. That's one kind of sign. The other kind of sign we've got is this board with the child's name written on it, a written sign. Isaiah then is encouraged by God, interestingly. God comes to Isaiah, encourages him to hold tightly to the promises. Because just as everyone else in Judah is at risk, Isaiah and his sons are at risk. And God is urging them to act faithfully to the promises that God has made. Trust in the promises that God has made. Let me read that. This is chapter 8, verses 16 and 19. He says, "Bind up the testimony, seal the law among my disciples, and I will wait for the Lord who is hiding his face from the house of Jacob. I will even look eagerly for him. Behold, I and the children whom the Lord has given me are for signs and wonders in Israel from the Lord of hosts who dwells on Mount Zion. And when they say to you, consult the mediums and the spiritists who whisper and mutter, should not a people consult their God? Should they consult the dead on behalf of the living? To the law and to the testimony. If they do not speak according to this word, it is because they have no dawn. And they will pass through the land hard-pressed and famished, and it will turn out that when they are hungry, they will be enraged and curse their king and their God as they face upward. Then they will look to the earth and behold distress and darkness, the gloom of anguish, and they will be driven away into darkness." So Isaiah and his sons have to face the same decision that the people of Judah have to face, and that is, do we trust God or do we not? And the consequences for Isaiah and his sons are just as great as for everyone else. And yet they are urged by God to be faithful, and Isaiah assures God, we will be faithful to those promises and to God. Chapter 9, then, is first half encouragement, and the second half is a description of afflictions that are yet to come to Judah. Let me read the first 7 verses of chapter 9, the encouragement about the time to come, the future of Judah. It says, "But there will be no more gloom for her who was in anguish. In earlier times, he treated the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali with contempt. But later on, he shall make it glorious by the way of the sea, on the other side of Jordan, Galilee of the Gentiles. The people who walk in darkness will see a great light. Those who live in a dark land, the light will shine on them. Thou shalt multiply the nation. Thou shalt increase their gladness. They will be glad in their presence, in thy presence, as with the gladness of harvest, as men rejoice when they divide the spoil. For thou shalt break the yoke of their burden and the staff on their shoulders, the rod of their oppressor, as at the battle of Midian. For every boot of the booted warrior in the battle tumult and the cloak rolled in blood will be for burning, fuel for the fire. For a child will be born to us, a son will be given to us, and the government will rest on his shoulders, and his name will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Eternal Father, Prince of Peace. There will be no end to the increase of his government or of peace on the throne of David and over his kingdom, to establish it and to uphold it with justice and righteousness from then on and forevermore. The zeal of the Lord of hosts will accomplish it. So a glorious future that's to come, and there will be a child that will come. And that child will provide the leadership for this eternal kingdom yet to come. The second half of 9 describes some of the afflictions that await Judah, that it will experience. Well, and then at the beginning of chapter 10, he proclaims a woe on those who are doing evil within the midst of Judah. And then things shift, and this is where we left off in the spring. We left off at the end of verse 4. In verse 5, there's another woe, but this time it is proclaimed against Assyria. Assyria, the agent that God will use to bring the affliction on Israel, on Judah. Let's read verses 5 through 11. Woe to Assyria, the rod of my anger, and the staff in whose hands is my indignation. I send it against a godless nation and commission it against the people of my fury, to capture booty and to seize plunder and to trample them down like mud in the streets. Yet it does not so intend, nor does it plan so in its heart, but rather it is its purpose to destroy and to cut off many nations. For it says, are not my princes all kings? Is not Calno like Carchemish? Or Hamath like Arpad, or Samaria like Damascus? As my hand is reached to the kingdoms of the idols, whose graven images were greater than those of Jerusalem and Samaria, shall I not do to Jerusalem and her images, just as I have done to Samaria and her idols? So here a woe is being proclaimed against Assyria, and Assyria is that nation that God has picked out to send against Judah in order to afflict Judah, discipline Judah for God's purposes. And it's interesting, in verse 7, he says, I send it against a godless nation. What is the godless nation? It's Judah. That God is describing Judah as a godless nation. It's a nation that is not faithful to God, and therefore godless. But Assyria is no less godless. It's a godless agent being sent against a godless people to discipline them. They are coming to capture booty and to seize plunder and to trample them down like mud in the streets. That sounds like the parable of the vineyard, where the farmer who built the vineyard, because it produced worthless grapes, he decided to tear down the walls and allow the vineyard to be trampled. Here's the trampling happening with respect to Judah. Now, Assyria is coming against Judah and is the agent of God's wrath against Judah, but Assyria is coming for a completely different reason. Assyria is coming to gain wealth. He says, yet it does not so intend, nor does it plan so in its heart, but rather its purpose is to destroy and to cut off many nations. It just wants to build an empire. That's what it's about. It's God's agent, but it thinks it's an empire builder. And he brags, are not our princes like kings elsewhere? And so it goes on to describe kingdoms that have been conquered by the Assyrians and turned over to Assyrian officials who rank lower than their king to rule. They go on to brag, Assyria goes on to brag, that his hand has reached to the kingdoms of the idols, whose graven images were greater than those of Jerusalem and Samaria. There are kingdoms whose idols are more powerful, stronger than those of Jerusalem and Samaria, and Assyria's wiped them out. So why are Jerusalem and Samaria going to present any difficulties? Jared Hooley was here during the summer, and he is in the Peace Corps in Africa. And he was talking about his experiences there, and it was kind of interesting. He was talking about magic is a big part of their culture, and different tribes have different reputations with respect to how strong that tribe's magic is. And then you can kind of list a hierarchy of the tribe's magic. It's kind of like the AP top 20, I think. But they're all ranked out, and you know which one has stronger magic than the others. Presumably, there's a similar kind of phenomenon happening here, and Assyria is saying, we wiped out the top 10. So what hope does Jerusalem and Samaria have when they aren't ranked at all? Okay, next section, 12 through 14. So it will be that when the Lord has completed all his work on Mount Zion and on Jerusalem, he will say, I will punish the fruit of the arrogant heart of the king of Assyria and the pomp of his haughtiness. For he has said, by the power of my hand and by my wisdom I did this, for I have understanding. And I removed the boundaries of the peoples and plundered their treasures, and like a mighty man, I brought down their inhabitants. And my hand reached to the riches of the peoples like a nest. And as one gathers abandoned eggs, I gathered all the earth. And there was not one that flapped its wing or opened its beak or chirped. So Assyria is thinking, all of this I am accomplishing because I'm great. I'm just invincible. It's by my hand. It's by my wisdom. It's by my understanding. And I'm the one that goes in and I move boundaries to my liking. I take treasure to my liking. I destroy the inhabitants to suit my purposes. The whole world is like an abandoned nest full of eggs. And I, Assyria, I just go and I pluck them out and stick them in my bag and take them home. There's no one there to defend them. Next section. Is the axe to boast itself over the one who chops with it? Is the saw to exalt itself over the one who wields it? That would be like a club wielding those who lift it, or like a rod lifting him who is not wood. Therefore the Lord, the God of hosts, will send a wasting disease among his stout warriors, and under his glory a fire will be kindled like a burning flame, and the light of Israel will become a fire, and his Holy One a flame, and it will burn and devour his thorns and his briars in a single day, and he will destroy the glory of his forest and of his fruitful garden, both soul and body. And it will be as when a sick man wastes away. And the rest of the trees of his forest will be so small in number that a child could write them down. So God is saying, Assyria, clearly does not understand the situation. Assyria is my agent. Assyria is a tool in my hands. And I will do with it as I will, and I have done with it as I wanted. And because of its arrogance, it will be destroyed. And he uses two different images to describe what will happen to Assyria. One is a wasting disease, and the other is a fire that will burn everything. The fire will be started by the light of Israel. I suspect that's an allusion back to the light that was referred to way back in chapter 9 when he said, the people who walk in darkness will see a great light. I don't know for sure that it's an allusion to that, but I'm suspicious that it is. The light of Israel will become a fire and his Holy One a flame, and it's going to burn the whole of Assyria. And it likens Assyria to a forest. We've got underbrush and we've got trees. And all of that's going to come down. All of that's going to be burned. The thorns, the briars, and the trees. Then it switches back to the other analogy, that is a sickness. Both soul and body it's going to affect, and it will be as when a sick man wastes away. Then switching back to the other analogy, and the rest of the trees of his forest will be so small in number that a child could write them down. And the reference here to a child is curious, and at some point we'll need to talk about that. Okay, so Assyria itself is going to be the target of God's wrath, and there will be a punishment that will come that can be likened to a fire, and it can be likened to a wasting disease. Verses 20 through 23. Now it will come about in that day that the remnant of Israel and those of the house of Jacob who have escaped will never again rely on the one who struck them, but will truly rely on the Lord, the Holy One of Israel. A remnant will return, the remnant of Jacob, to the mighty God. For though your people, O Israel, may be like the sand of the sea, only a remnant within them will return. A destruction is determined, overflowing with righteousness. For a complete destruction, one that is decreed, the Lord of God of hosts will execute in the midst of the whole land. So again, this destruction that's coming on Jerusalem, on Judah, is going to be extensive. But in the end, a remnant will remain, and that remnant will rely on the God, the Holy One of Israel. Verse 24 through 27. Therefore, thus says the Lord God of hosts, O my people who dwell in Zion, do not fear the Assyrian who strikes you with the rod and lifts up his staff against you the way Egypt did. For in a very little while, my indignation against you will be spent, and my anger will be directed to their destruction. And the Lord of hosts will arouse a scourge against him like the slaughter of Midian at the rock of Oreb, and his staff will be over the sea, and he will lift it up the way he did in Egypt. So it will be in that day that his burden will be removed from your shoulders and his yoke from your neck, and the yoke will be broken because of fatness. So the time is going to come when God will relent with respect to his wrath towards Judah, and he will turn instead on those who have been the instruments of his wrath, those who have been the agents of his wrath. And in particular, he talks about the Assyrian. The Assyrians, as they come, they are going to be cruel overlords. But just as their overlords in Egypt were overthrown by the miraculous acts of God, this overlord will be overthrown in a similar fashion. 28 through 32. He has come against Aiath, He has passed through Migron. At Michmash, he deposited his baggage. They have gone through the pass saying, Geba will be our lodging place. Ramah is terrified, and Gibeah of Saul has fled away. Cry aloud with your voice, O daughter of Galim. Pay attention, Laisha, and wretched Ananath. Madmenah has fled, and the inhabitants of Gebim have sought refuge. Yet today he will halt at Nob. He shakes his fist at the mountain of the daughter of Zion, the hill of Jerusalem. What it's describing here is progress from north to south towards Jerusalem. That these cities line up from north to south, each one closer than the former to Jerusalem. So it seems to be the description of a march, this ominous march towards Jerusalem. Interestingly, this is not the path that the Assyrians followed. We have three accounts of the Assyrians coming and attacking Judah. We have one later in Isaiah, and we'll talk about it when we get there. It's in chapter 37, I believe. We have another description in the annals of Sennacherib. He was the king of Assyria at the time that the Assyrians attacked Jerusalem, and he had a history written of the account. And that history that he had written survived. We have it, and it has been translated. And we'll talk about all of this more later. We also have a description of it in Herodotus, the Greek historian. But we know from those accounts that this does not describe the march that the Assyrians took when they came to Jerusalem. They actually came up from the southwest. So I'm not sure what we are to make of this progression from north to south. It may not be a description of the march of the Assyrians. It may just be a way of capturing the kind of ominous feel that's created when the Assyrians start marching on Jerusalem by just logging off the cities as they get closer and closer to Jerusalem. That's a possibility. Curiously, however, in one of the commentaries found in the Qumran scrolls, in a commentary on Isaiah, it thinks that this refers not to the march of Sennacherib, but the march of Gog and Magog at a later time when they march on Jerusalem. Okay, the last two verses. Behold, the Lord, the God of hosts, will lop off the boughs with a terrible crash. Those also who are tall in stature will be cut down, and those who are lofty will be abased. And he will cut down the thickets of the forest with an iron axe, and Lebanon will fall by the Mighty One. Here, this is repeating language that we saw earlier. It's very similar to language that we saw earlier when God said that he's going to take everything that's tall and bring it down. And here, it seems to be referring more specifically to those who have been arrogant with respect to Judah, who have been brought by God as instruments of God's wrath against Judah, and yet have been arrogant in doing so, thinking that it was their doing, and God is going to bring them down. Okay. There are a few things that I would like to comment on in this section. The first is, and I think this is an important one to keep in mind, and it's a little bit hard to wrap your mind around, I think, but in the Old Testament, the story that's being told by the prophets in particular, but also in the historical narratives as well, is it's basically the dealings of God with respect to his people as a whole. And God made promises to that people. And what it's tracing is how God relates to that people, how that people relates back to God, what God does in response. And in the end, and most importantly, we see God's faithfulness to the promises that he made to that people. So it's the story of one entity, God, with respect to another single entity, that is Israel. It's important to understand that that's the kind of story that's being told, because it's easy to start worrying about the individuals within Israel. What about the people who were killed? Did they all deserve it? And so what if some of Israel remains? If in the midst of that I died, is there any significance that Israel remained? And from the biblical perspective, absolutely there's significance. Because there continued to be that entity with which God was dealing and to whom God made promises and to whom God will fulfill those promises. That is critical. So when we have someone by the name of Sher Jashub, which means a remnant shall remain, that is good news. That means that God's promises can be fulfilled and will be fulfilled. Now, there are individuals that are also active in this history. And I'm confident that God is dealing with them justly in the way that he deals with individuals. But the story that's being presented in the Old Testament is, by and large, doesn't have to do with that. It has to do with God dealing with the nation of Israel as a whole. And that has great carryover for us. Just as God is faithful to his people Israel, God is faithful to us as individuals in the promises that he has made to us. Just as God is willing to discipline Israel, God is willing to discipline us as individuals. But just as that discipline led to a glorious future for Israel, or is leading to a glorious future for Israel, that discipline of us as individuals is leading to a glorious future for us. So there's a lot of analogy between those two stories, but the story that's being told in the Old Testament is God and Israel as a whole. The second thing, we have Assyria here being punished for doing what God told Assyria to do. There's a tension here, and this is stuff that Jack has talked about a lot, and it's the kind of thing that's really hard to get straight in your head. But these things, there are two things that seem to be really clear in the teaching of Scripture, as far as I'm concerned. One is, God is absolutely sovereign. Everything that happens is because God authored it to happen. God made it happen. There isn't anything in this world that happens independent of God. He has done it all. He is truly sovereign on the one hand. But another clear teaching of Scripture is, what we do is our doing, and we are responsible for that. Both of those are true. It's hard to put those two things together. Jack has come up with a way of conceiving of that. Whether you buy the way Jack has put it together or not, I think that if you're going to be faithful to Scripture, you have to accept those two principles nevertheless. That God is sovereign over absolutely everything, but we are responsible for every action that we take. And therefore, we can be punished, justly punished, for every action that we take. The third thing I want to talk about is this giftedness of Assyria. Assyria is seeing itself as gifted in the sense of it's just doing great things. It is just the kind of country, the kind of people that comes in and easily conquers all of the surrounding kingdoms. And it easily plunders them. And it easily restructures the whole Near East. I have thought about giftedness a lot. It's just the kind of topic that's been of interest to me. And I'm convinced that there are a couple of kinds of giftedness. One kind of giftedness is when God gives someone talents and skills that make them especially good at something. That somehow they've got the ability to be truly remarkable. I mean, someone like Michael Jordan. There's someone who he's a gifted basketball player. He's got a whole bunch of qualities that all combine to make him really good at playing that particular game. And I'm going to call that attributive giftedness. That is, it's a giftedness that results from somebody's attributes. There's another kind of giftedness that I'm going to call occasional giftedness. And what I'm talking about is there are people who can do things and get remarkable results, but it's difficult to trace what they accomplished back through talents and skills to explain it. I'm going to use the example of Tim Tebow here, because the critics all look at Tim Tebow as a quarterback and say he is lacking in the kinds of talents and skills that you need to be a good quarterback. He just doesn't have them. It just so happened last year that he led the Broncos, 8 straight victories. But nobody could account for those victories. Nobody could look at Tebow and say, I know how that happened. He's got the skills and ability that made that possible. They all look at Tim Tebow and they go, I don't know what happened. That's what I call occasional giftedness. It's on occasion. It's not out of one's attributes, but it's on occasion that things turn out positively, positive results. That distinction is significant to me because I identify with the latter more than the former. I really think if God had made me a basketball player, I'd be the kind of player that would clumsily dribble the ball down the court and clumsily throw the ball up, and it might go in more often than it should. I can't really account for it. It just did. But that occasional giftedness is kind of a blessing, because the attributive giftedness gives the illusion that it's you yourself that did it, and there's no giftedness involved. Those skills and talents aren't a gift. They're mine. They're me. I'm just exceptional. I'm just inherently exceptional. And that's why there are exceptional results that happen. And that's kind of the perspective that Assyria has adopted here. It is just an exceptional people, and have completely lost track of the reality that there's a giftedness there. None of that would be possible were it not for God making it possible. So in both kinds of giftedness, if there is a gift, the only question is the person aware of that giftedness or not? Okay. We don't have a lot of time. We'll take a little time for any questions or comments that people want to make.
Dave, I think I was uncertain as to whether you were identifying Jerusalem, the future city of righteousness, with Israel or with Judah. I think sometimes you referred to both. Mm-hmm. And is that a border dispute, or is that a time that you need to explain to me?
Specifically, what's involved here in this, in what Isaiah is saying, he's talking to the people of Judah. But in the process of so doing, he seems to be including the northern kingdom in some of his comments as well. So he's talking to the people of Judah, but there are promises that have been made to both Israel and Judah that are relevant here, and he brings those in. So I am blending the two from time to time, but I hope that I'm following the pattern of Isaiah, who is also blending the two from time to time. That he is specifically talking to Judah here, but there are promises that were made to Israel at the same time as they were made to Judah. They still apply to Israel, and so they will; those two will come to pass.
Okay, and Jerusalem is located where?
In Judah. In Judah.
Thanks.
Could you refresh my memory as to the Battle of Midian?
Mm-hmm. That's Gideon.
Midian.
And Gideon was there, was the commander at that time, at that battle. So that was the time when, you know, remember, Gideon was called by God to lead the army, and he throws out the two fleeces, and finally he decides, yeah, I'm supposed to do this. So he pulls together this army, and God says, you don't need that many people. So he reduces the army down to 300 people. And then they go with torches under jars, and they surround the enemy, and then they all break their jars at the same time. So then there are all these torches that are burning. The enemy becomes confused and in turmoil, and they end up killing each other. And so there is a battle in which a much bigger enemy is defeated, where there's actually very little fighting that happens. Between the Israelites and the people of Midian. So it's a miraculous kind of thing where a foe of overwhelming force essentially turns on itself and is destroyed.
And is that kind of what he did with Assyria?
Well, kind of. It's not entirely clear what happens to Assyria because of the different accounts. And there's the question of whether Assyria came one time or came twice, because the accounts differ a little bit. But the story that we get in Isaiah 37 is that Assyria comes down to the environs of Jerusalem and is ready to attack Jerusalem. It has defeated all of the major cities in Judah on its way to Jerusalem. Jerusalem's all that's left. And they are on the outskirts of Jerusalem, threatening to attack at any time. And as Sennacherib's annals describe it, I held Jerusalem like a bird in a cage. Those are the words that he uses. But the next day, the whole army is gone. And apparently, a disease strikes the camp, and whoever is still alive, they flee. And Jerusalem is not taken by the Assyrians as a result. One more.
I'm wondering, in verse 20, when it says, now it will come about in that day that the remnant of Israel and those of the house of Jacob who have escaped will never again rely on the one who struck them, but will truly rely on the Lord, the Holy One of Israel. It seems like it's saying that, like, that day seems referring to when Assyria is punished. But I'm wondering, like, why it's saying that, like, Israel will then truly rely on the Lord in that day, because Assyria is, you know, not around today, but there's nobody who in Israel who would completely rely on, you know, God. So you can't really say that. So I'm wondering why it says that.
That's a good question. And that is a conundrum that we are going to face throughout this. That is to say that there are a lot of claims that are made here in Isaiah that for which there is not an exact historic analog. Does that make sense? That there's not an exact historical reference. And the question is, what does that mean? How are we supposed to take that? Is it that the description is poetic and maybe hyperbolic, exaggerated, such that if we look at the historical accounts that we can find something that is close to it? Or the possibility is it hasn't happened yet. We're going to wrestle with that tension a lot over the next few chapters. And I have not entirely resolved that but it is something that we will need to talk about. It's a tough one. Do you see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
So, good question. Okay. We will come back to it.
Okay.
Okay, thank you.